We're very happy to have Greg Powlis here in these dark times. Maybe a little bit of twisted humor may help lighten the moment a little bit. You may have heard the not-so-funny story about embedded reporters in bed with the military. More apropos to the event today, he's been called twisted and maniacal by Catherine Harris. The White House says, "We hate that son of a bitch." The Baltimore Chronicle says no one has investigated the Bush clan like Greg Powlis and has lived to write about it. And Michael Moore says simply, courageous reporting, and read the book, The Best Democracy Money Can Buy, newly published this edition with much new material, is available for your purchase from the good folks at Cody's. And I'm going to say just a little bit more about our guest, and I'll turn the mic over to Greg. Greg Powlis is an award-winning reporter for BBC Television's Newsnight, and he writes for The Guardian newspapers of London. His extraordinary reports have been front-page news in Europe, yet blocked out of America's mainstream media, except, of course, for KPFA and Pacifica. And Greg has very generously been donating his time and his wisdom to do fundraisers for KPFA and other Pacifica stations, now SF Indie Media. We're very happy to be working with SF Indie Media on this. And let me just add this. A former World Bank chief economist told Greg that the bank, quote, condemned people to death. This is the kind of reporting that you don't hear on the mainstream media, the corporate media, and you will never hear the truth from embedded reporters. So it's my pleasure to turn the mic over to Greg Powlis.
Wow. Thank you. All right. You might not like what I say. Don't clap in advance. John, thank you. Wow. Indie media, what a pleasure, because, you know, usually I get on these programs for, you know, the enslaved media, you know, so it's like, so any chance I can, do something for indie media, believe me, it's really a pleasure and a treasure, and especially you're talking to, you know, a guy who's been exiled by the mainstream press. You can tell, you know, they're all often, the radio stations here are surprised when they hear my American accent because, they thought I was British. You know, I get all these, like, you know, if you read the book, there's a letter from one of my fans saying, kiss my ass, you British pansy. I don't like being called British, and you know, so I don't know. There's a lot of topics I could talk about our war hero, the president, but I want to give you an idea of what's so scary that you're not allowed to see it. You know, like, and how I try to go about reporting. I have the great advantage of course, of having never gone to journalism school. In fact, I'm a bit worried that my book is now being used as textbooks at Columbia School of Journalism because it's kind of a lie, because it's a quick route to, you know, if you read the book, just remember, do not do this at home. You know, do not do this on American soil. because you will be quickly unemployable. I just came back from Salon.com, and they wrote an article about the Bush family on trying to shut down and silence this muckraking reporter. And I said, Seymour Hersh said, they called you muckraker. You are now completely unemployable in the United States. You're supposed to be muck takers. You're supposed to be with the importance of journalism school is to teach you stenography so you can be repeaters, not reporters. I actually had a guy on my TV show in Britain, this pathetic guy, a reporter, said he was afraid to ask tough questions that he knows he ought to ask. This is Dan Rather, by the way, who said, yes, Dan, without his makeup, he has electronic makeup. Did you know that? They digitize his face, and he has digitalized makeup. Really. And if your face isn't yours, and Ted Koppel, we'll get to that, has as much hair as I do, so if you're missing any cats, yeah. So here's some of the stuff. I just thought I'd actually give you some of the stories that would make you unemployable if you tried this at home in the U.S. And actually, you should understand under the USA Patriot Act that investigative reporting starting May 1st does become illegal. So it's So one thing. I just want to go back to the Florida election. Oh, I guess I'm not supposed to because you're supposed to move on, right? So, but let's. What do you move on from when you move on from democracy? Well, I kind of stand right here and talk to you about it. I was home in London watching my own program. It was a night off, so. It was election night, and then the next night I was watching black people come in front of the camera. And the BBC camera saying we couldn't vote. My brothers, I showed up and they said I knocked off a 7-Eleven in Utah in 1964, so I'm a felon and I can't vote. Stories like that. And I kept seeing all these African American faces. It didn't seem to bother the U.S. newsmen. Blacks are always complaining. You know how they are. They always want that affirmative action thing. And. But I was thinking, you have to understand how I think. If you saw politically incorrect, I'm politically incorrect, I was called a conspiracy nut, which, does get a laugh from the conspirators. And so conspiracy nut that I am, I'm watching these black people go across the screen, get on the TV screen. You don't have a lot of black people get on TV screens in America, but in Britain, it's not against our rules. I was thinking, it's almost as if there were like a computer program which is zooming in on black people and removing them from the voter rolls. So this is a CD-ROM from the program from Catherine Harris's office. Okay. What this is, that was a very hard, I used the difficult investigative technique of asking for it. A lot of American reporters, it was a difficult step for them to take. That won't happen anymore. That was when we had a Freedom of Information Act, and we're missing the two key elements, freedom and information these days. We had the Freedom of Information Act, and we got the disks from her office, cracked them. Greg Palast is not, a person, I'm a team, right? And a lot of volunteers here in America, so please sign up at my website, www.gregpalast.com, say you want to help out. I mean it. God, do I need filmmaking help at this moment, too, so please, indie media people, break the chains, join up. Look at this disk, and I didn't bring the. We'll bring a computer sometimes to just show you what it looks like. There is a list in here of 57,000 names of Florida voters who were marked for removal from the voter rolls because supposedly they had registered illegally. They were felons, not allowed to vote in Florida. So I'm going through this list. I'm actually going through the database after we cracked the disk. And I'm, you know, looking down the names. Who are they excluding from voting? And there's Thomas Cooper. It was Thomas Cooper, who was convicted. I go across the line. It says convicted on January 30th, 2007. Which, because I hadn't gone to American Journalism School, I thought that was interesting. And I found a lot of, like, you know, criminals of the future. It's like, well, listen, hand it to Catherine Harris. She stops the crime before it starts, like The Matrix. You know? So I looked at that, and there were 500 convicts of the future, and there were also 4,000 blank conviction dates. And I went back and got the email traffic from her Department of Elections, which is under her office, again using that difficult investigative technique of asking for the email traffic. But you have to go through this stuff, you know, time, cost, risk of these stories. You know, that Rupert Murdoch has a lot of interest in spending time, money, and taking risks. BBC allowed me to do this Guardian newspaper. So I go through the email traffic. What do they say? Clerks are saying, we're removing people who are convicted in the future. What should we do? Well, I thought, well, maybe, you know, you'd think, well, how about not remove them from the list? The answer from the Republican functionaries was, if you blank out the conviction dates, no one will know. And that's 4,000 blank conviction dates. Now, but of course, who's getting knocked out? You know, once again, so the reporters, there had been some glitches, a lot of his glitches, before the election. The Palm Beach Post actually had the temerity to say that they discovered the purge story, the story of the purge of black voters before the election. Yeah, they had gotten wind that there was a mistake in the office, and they ran an article saying it had all been corrected and that they have the most advanced system in Florida. That was the Palm Beach Post. And I also saw an email which said, boy, we really put one over on the Post. So what happened was, if you look down the list, it says, next to the names also says, BLA, BLA, WHI, WHI, BLA, BLA, BLA. Huh. It looks like a South African apartheid-era police roster. Has races written right next to every name on all the voter registration forms in Florida. That was meant, by the way, originally was intended to protect African American voters in the Voting Rights Act of 65. You know, before computers were used, this was a way for the Justice Department to see that African Americans were treated fairly, because you have to understand, in Northern Florida especially, if a black person voted in 1950, that would be their last, the last thing they'd be doing on this earth. And you can't understand the story without understanding the Jim Crow history. So I looked at this list, and lo and behold, I asked the question, I called up an elections supervisor, county election supervisor, statistician. I said, about, by any chance, what is the racial breakdown of the people that were scrubbed from the voter rolls? And the official said, I've been waiting for someone to ask me that. Since, you know, the St. Petersburg Times, or this was Tampa, you know, their local reporters kind of never asked. So I said, the answer is 54% of the names on the list. But when the clerks challenged this, went to Harris's office, said, why are these lists mostly of African Americans and Hispanics? They said, well, you know, criminal statistics in the U.S. show that they commit most of the crimes. Of course, what was interesting is that we now know, we did analysis of the list, at a minimum 90.2% of people on the list were innocent of anything other than being African American. The more Thomas Coopers and Johnny Jacksons. If your name was Johnny Jackson and someone named John Jackson or Jim Jackson in another state 20 years earlier committed a crime, you would lose your vote as long as your race matched up. So do the arithmetic. I mean, BBC figured, and now that number is really conservative, 20,000 votes lost to Al Gore, minimum, under this game. Catherine Harris declared Bush the winner by 537 votes in Florida. But this is a media discussion, which is where were they? You know, where were our guys? I try to get this. I did. By the way, this was front page news when I broke this story, the voter purge, in London. In the Washington Post was page zero. New York paper record. New York Times page zero. Until I have to say, the Washington Post did give me a byline on the story. I broke the story. First report on the story. Voter purge was 3 weeks after the election. Al Gore was still in the race. The Washington Post did cover the story and then give me a byline 7 months after I wrote it, when the U.S. Civil Rights Commission said my information was correct and they could. Well, the Washington Post is a very good paper to come out of the hills and shoot the wounded. So, you know, if they had the rock of the official approval to hide behind, and they say, oh, yeah, look what happened there. And it's, of course, by that time, Bush is reading it and giggling from the White House, and it's, you know, back in the paper. And that's, you know, that is one of the better papers. I always think of the Post and the Times. When I think of the top 50 papers on this planet, they're always on the list. But so I couldn't get this story into the U.S. mainstream press, so I did come into Salon.com to come in here. It was also at the top of the nightly news, but again, in Europe, they thought it was kind of interesting that the president of the United States wasn't elected. But people stop me on the street and say, you know, they saw my report on TV, they would say, wow, so Bush has to resign now, right? No. Al Gore said we can affirm our democracy by not counting votes. An interesting thing to give you an idea of how U.S. news operates. I found something else was very interesting, and I have to say Ted Koppel's team discovered it too. Which is that if you go county by county in Florida, there's 67 counties, and you look at the number of votes not counted. Votes not counted? Wait a minute. Didn't James Baker say that the votes have been counted six times? Didn't you read that in your paper a million times and, you know, get over it, move on? Votes have been counted six times. 108, except for the 180,000 votes that weren't counted because they were spoiled. And that was reported by the papers. But I thought, In Britain, they said, what do you mean by spoiled ballot? How do you spoil a ballot? You leave it out of the fridge? So I said, how do you spoil a ballot? And you know, they had things like, you know, people would mark Al Gore's name off and write in Al Gore. That vote didn't count. It was spoiled. The intent of the voter is supposed to rule in Florida, as in all other states. Catherine Harris, when someone wrote in Al Gore's name and checked his name, couldn't figure out the voter's intent. And neither could the U.S. Newspapers. The consortium of papers. This is the stuff that they were seeing, and they were that so-called consortium. They were saying, yeah, those are ballots which shouldn't count. Very interesting. So anyway, so Ted Koppel, who has the right, I'm BBC's ABC, we have a film trading agreement. His News Nightline and my News Night can trade film. So, you know, he could have used some of my material. And decided to do his own thing. Good. or his team did, you know, his handlers or whatever they are, the people that glue the wig on. They go down, and they want, there's 67 counties in Florida. Whether a vote counts or not is almost identical. The number of uncounted votes per county is identical to the number of, to the proportion of black people in those counties. Interesting statistic. And I will hand it to ABC Nightline for going to investigate. And so their investigation, they talked to the state, which said, well, you know, it's difficult for black people to vote, they're new voters, and they got professors saying it's so difficult for these new black voters, they don't have a lot of education, the ballot's complicated, sophisticated, we don't do enough voter education, isn't that terrible? And they ran a nice liberal report, there ought to be more voter education because blacks is basically too friggin' dumb to vote. Can't figure out the ballot. I decided to kind of check it out myself, and I was in Tallahassee, the capital, and Leon County, most ballots were paper ballots in Florida. And in Gadsden County, of 67 counties, the blackest county, over half of the citizens are African American. 1 in 8 votes was never counted, was spoiled. 1 in 8 votes. Gadsden alone, and this was never reported in America, Gadsden alone accounted for the margin of victory for Bush. Those spoiled ballots. How did they get spoiled? And Leon County is right next door, and they had almost no spoiled ballots. Same paper ballot. Both are optically red. Both are optically red. Right? So I go, and they have a voting booth set up. Like, it looks like this, you know, to practice in the county vote registrar's office. So I take my ballot, I take a toy ballot, and it actually has a presidential name, so I mark off, as I did in real life, Pat Buchanan and Ralph Nader, and I stick it in the machine, and then it goes zip back into my hands. And I stick it in the machine again, zip back into my hands. You know, like when you try to put Monopoly money into a bill change or something, it comes back at you. And so I call over the clerk. I was doing, actually, for so many of you are studying film and news here, I was actually doing it just, I wasn't, you know, I was in the investigation, I wasn't looking for trouble. And I stick it in, and because I had a film crew doing B-roll, which if you're in indie media, you may be unfamiliar with the concept, which is that you kind of try to liven up the thing with some pictures as opposed to, you know, the usual 5 hours of Noam Chomsky tight in. Don't move the camera. In indie media. Yeah. Yeah. You know, they're not glued to the tripod. So I was voting, so they're doing this B-roll stuff, you know, I'm voting. And then I said, call over the clerk, say, what is this? She says, well, you mismarked your ballot, so it came back to you. You mismarked your ballot, and so we got to give you a new one. And I said, wait a minute. How could ballots spoil if the machine rejects you, get a new one? She says, oh, it can't. It's almost impossible. You get 3 tries in Florida under the law. And I said, well, then what happened to Gadsden? They have the same ballots, same optical readers. He said, you know, and 1 in 8 votes was not counted. I said, how could those votes be spoiled? He says, well, it depends how you set up the machine. Oh. Ted. And so it's not that the voter, black people, is too dumb to vote, but maybe the white reporters is too dumb to ask, right? You know, if you have a story on, you know, dumb black people as opposed to stupid white men, the dumb black people story, that will work. You know, criminals, dumb black people. Yeah, and once I discovered that, that's, yeah, you read about that, right? Yeah. I did another thing. I did something you're not allowed to do on U.S. television, which is to ask some questions interview subjects. I was very interested. I found a document marked Secret and Confidential from within the Florida Department of Elections. And can I get a little more? Can someone throw a little water in this cup? Florida Department, or just give me that bottle if you don't mind. Thank you. I owe you. Thanks. I go into Florida, so I get this document which says that this purge list, this neat little purge list, this rotten little blacklist, which is knocking off thousands of black people, was created by a company named Choice Point, and they replaced another company that had been doing the work for $5,000 a year for the state, but the rotten list was they paid $2 million for. Now, that kind of interested me, you know, which didn't seem to get any rise out of the U.S. report. I thought that was kind of interesting. So I thought I'd ask about this $2 million, and on this sheet marked Secret and Confidential, it said the $2 million was principally for manual verification by telephone. That's a quote from the document of this list. Because this database company was being paid the extra money, and I have a photocopy of the check that they received, the extra money to actually verify that these people really were who they said they were. Because there's an awful lot of people named John Smith on that list. So which one is it? So you check the databases, you do a bunch of calling. It's a typical thing that these database companies do, and it costs a lot of money. And I asked them for the phone calls, the sheets of phone calls that they made, and they said, well, we didn't actually make any phone calls. And I thought, gee, I want to ask Catherine Harris's team about that. And her head of her Department of Elections, who's one of Republican functionaries, who's always by her side. When you see this squat little, like, Doberman-looking guy, that's Clayton Roberts, kind of bull-necked, red-faced. And he's running the Department of Elections. So I thought I'd ask Clayton to explain this to me, the $2 million for the calls that were never made. That they didn't want, maybe, made, because that would have cut the list from 57,000 to 6. According to the Attorney General of Florida, he said if he found someone illegally registered, he'd arrest them. I said, here's the list, it's a crime wave, 57,000. Yeah, I look through the list, we have 6 open cases. So I thought I'd ask Clayton about this. So I go to him. I don't have a document. If you look in the book, you'll see the document. So it's very clear. He knows I'm looking at Secret Confidential, and I'm sitting there, BBC interview, very formal. You know, you got the little lapel mics on, and I start chatting. And then I begin to pull out the Secret Confidential document. He rips off the microphone, does a runner into his office, slams the door in my face, and calls in the state troopers to remove me and my camera crew from the building. I guess he had another appointment. And now, what's interesting is that on U.S. TV, if someone says, you know, he said, and this interview is over, bang, off the mic. As soon as I pulled out the material and began to ask him. And I did something you're not allowed to do on ABC or whatever. I've never seen him do it, which is actually, I try to follow up the question. And you can see the kind of Roberts run. I was making a film for BBC, but there was a PBS film crew filming Robert. And so they have this too. And that film is called Counting on Democracy. And you can actually sign up for it here, because one of the interesting things is that the PBS network, when they realized what was in the film that they paid for and who their new boss was, decided maybe we shouldn't put this on the satellite. So they didn't. But I do want to congratulate the San Francisco PBS and a few other stand-up affiliates, which basically ran the film in defiance of the network. And I've now made it I've added, it wasn't my film, but I have now added to the film with Danny Schechter, who's a legend in filmmaking. He won all these Emmys. They still wouldn't run his film, you know. We've added some material to it, so you can actually sign up if you're interested in taking a look at that, buying that or something. We're making it like dirt cheap so we can get it around, even if they don't want us to get it around. Or you can see the Clayton run in, on my website, www.gregpalace.com. You can see these BBC television reports I do at my website, Real Video, www.gregpalace.com. And so you want to just see what's so scary that I do. So Clayton did his run. And the other thing was that the NAACP sued, and Catherine Harris and Jeb said, we did it. They didn't agree that it was deliberate. Gee, are we sorry that these poor black people were not allowed to vote? We'll put them back on the voter rolls. This is when Jeb was running for his life for re-election. It looked like he might go down. He says, we'll get it. You know, things are kind of busy right now with the election. We'll get their names back on the voter rolls right in January after the election. So those turns out to be 97,000 names. I was wrong. It was 97,000 names, and they're still not back on the voter rolls today. You read about that. Yeah, sure. If you swim across the Atlantic with your television, plug it in, and you can get the news. There's a lot of things that I can do. I appreciate all the stuff about great, you know, I'm a terrific reporter, all that stuff, and that's really nice. I appreciate Michael Moore's good comments and help. But it's not that I'm a courageous reporter, is that what we are missing in America are courageous editors and courageous producers. There's plenty of you right in this room who could do what I would do if someone would let you, right? So that's what we really need to change that culture. Like I say, we got to have independent media and not the enchained media, embedded media, as John said. There is, I ran another story, which on the top of the BBC Nightly News, which won a Project Censored Award from the California State University Journalism School. So this is the exact award you don't want to win. You get an award for having a story that no one would publish, right? It was unusual for a Project Censored Award because it was one of the most reprinted and highly broadcast stories in a long time, because it was on the top of the BBC Nightly News on four continents, went in everywhere except it kind of, the signals kind of bounced off of the U.S. You didn't see it. And it was, you know, top front page news around the world. It was, we uncovered some documents and spoke to some FBI and CIA agents who gave us information, evidence that Bush had quashed the investigation of, or hindered the investigation of the Saudi Arabian financing of terrorism, including Al-Qaeda, and had, was not allowing an investigation of the American side of the bin Laden family. Now, this is, by the way, I want to tell you, there's no evidence here that Bush knew about September 11th in advance or planned it or any of that stuff. What it was a prejudice. It's not what he knew. It's what he worked at not knowing, which is taking over a Clinton administration view, but he strengthened it, which was that you don't bother the guy sitting on the oil spigots. And in Bush's case, it had an extra little bit of flair, because, you know, when he talks about, you know, there's thousands of people out there who want to kill us and their supporters, and he could have added, and some of them are my business partners. So we talked about that, and you'll see in the book a meeting, you know, that. So we couldn't get that out. But it's very funny. We got the. Cynthia McKinney had called for a follow-up. She's been an avid reader of my material, and she gets my BBC transcripts all the time. unfortunately for her in her political career, because she thought that there ought to be a follow-up to our story, that there ought to be an congressional investigation. And so she called for investigating, following up on this story, from this award-winning story from BBC Television, for which then the New York Times wrote, I wonder if I even have the exact quote from the New York Times, yes, McKinney implied that the Bush administration knew in advance about September 11th and deliberately held back the information. New York Times ran that, which allowed her own party, Senator Zell Miller, to call her loony and dangerous. NPR called her a loose cannon and said that she accused the president of murder. This is National Public Radio, by saying that she accused the president of knowing about September 11th in advance and withholding it so his cronies can profit. I was very interested in this because I looked in the congressional record and I couldn't find it. I looked on her website and I couldn't find it, and I talked to the congresswoman who said she never said it. And they didn't run, by the way, those denials in the press. So I called up the reporter from the New York Times. I happened to have my tape recorder on, asking. For those of you who are unfamiliar, I also do a lot of stories, which they don't do in the United States, in which I wear a wire. And New York Times reporter, so I said, I'm trying to find the source of your quote. And she said, well, quote, I've heard it. It was all over the place. I said, yeah, after you reported it, it sure was. She says, it was in the House transcripts. I said, I have every statement this congresswoman ever made in the House. It's not there. Can you recall maybe where it was? We went round and round. She said, well, maybe it was in the Atlanta Constitution. No, they quoted you. Maybe it was. And then what they said is, they finally came down, NPR said it was on some wacko left-wing program by Dennis Bernstein, Free Speech Radio, KPFA. Because Dennis was asking her about my reports, and she just said that worth following up, right? And so Dennis keeps the transcripts, so I went through them. Couldn't find it. But then NPR, like I say, then ran the same phrases, including comments from people on the street that she's dangerous, a lunatic, and, of course, she lost her House seat over this, including the fact that black leadership of Atlanta had abandoned her. And they did. It was interesting. Two members of the Atlanta establishment, Vernon Jordan and Andy Young, wouldn't back her. They also said that Julian Bond wouldn't back her, and one of the few times that the Times ran a retraction on their website saying, well, that wasn't really true. But now what's interesting about that is another story you may not have heard of, which is that after Bush left the White House, he went to work for a Canadian gold mining, Bush Sr., went to work for Canadian Gold Mining Corporation. And I found that kind of interesting because I've been seeing that they were giving donations to the Republican Party, a little bit to the Democrats. That's how they do it. They inoculate themselves from the complaint by giving a little bit, by tube-feeding the Democrats a little candy and giving the candy store to the Republicans. So I was looking up, who is Barrick Gold Mining? Barrick Gold Mining was founded by that Canadian, that well-known Canadian, Adnan Khashoggi, and the arms dealer. And Adnan, when things got a little difficult around the Iran-Contra time, he left and Bush jumped in. But what do you do with a used president? I mean, I was interested. It didn't seem like the U.S. reporters had a huge amount of interest, but I thought, what's he doing, our president, doing on a Canadian working for a Canadian corporation. And it turns out, what did he may have done before that might have caught their attention? And just before Bush left office, his administration changed the rules for gold, for staking gold mine claims in the U.S. You know, there's still the old Prospectors Act. If you find a nugget of gold, you can go stake a claim at the claims office. You know, Eureka, I found it, go stake a claim, you know, it's like Treasure Sierra Madre, and for $5 you get to stake a claim on an acre of property. Well, Bush changed the procedure, or his administration changed the procedure just before he left, and allowed Barrick Gold Mining of Canada to stake a claim on $10 billion worth of gold ore, the biggest gold mine in North America, for which they paid the Treasury to stake the claim a little under $10,000. $10 billion worth of ore, $10,000 claim, and Bush gets a job. Now, that wasn't reported. I was very interested in exactly why this wasn't reported, and then I kind of found out why, because when I reported it, my paper was sued, The Guardian. Now, in Britain, we don't have a First Amendment. By the way, I want to tell you, this is very valuable. If you have my hardbound, you have to get the paperback because it's twice as long, because there's a lot I cannot write in Britain. One of my sources, David Shaler, I could say his name now, he is serving 6 months in the Queen's dungeon for giving my paper, writing a letter to my paper, for giving us some public, for telling us the name of a website in the USA that has MI5 documents on it. He's serving 6 months in high security prison right now. Official Secrets Act. We have a First Amendment in the United States. I mean, I think Britain should have one. They can use ours because we're not. But being sued in a nation without a First Amendment ain't fun, because what they said was a reasonable person reading these facts about the gold mine for $10,000. They said, they didn't deny it. They said, yeah, Khashoggi helped found the company and Bush went to work, and we got the gold mine for $10,000. But a reasonable person reading these facts might think that there's some connection between Bush's job. So to save my paper from going bankrupt, one of the reasons, by the way, I can report what I report in The Guardian is that they're owned by a nonprofit trust. It's a nonprofit newspaper. Most people don't realize that. It is not. You can't buy Guardian stock. It is run by a foundation, which is a not-for-profit foundation. They've got the money to fight billionaire gold diggers, you know. So I signed a statement saying there's no connection. Yeah, I'll go along with that. No connection. And you read about that, right? Actually, it's funny. There's a front-page article in the New York Times in 2001 saying that gold companies were being let off the hook in Nevada from costly environmental protection rules. It's big, you know, very New York Times. We're going after the real meat. This doesn't look good. Page one, 40 column inches, big darn story about gold mining companies in Nevada let off the hook by the Bush administration. I was with Seymour Hersh with the Columbia School of Journalism. I held it up. I said, two names are missing from this article, this long front page article under the title All the News That's Fit to Print. The biggest gold mining company in Nevada, Barrick, and the name George Bush. I said, kind of interesting thing to leave out of an article about Nevada gold mining, the name of the biggest gold mining company, and the Bush administration is Bush and the name of the gold mining company. Which had, of course, nothing to do with the fact that we share the same lawyer, Floyd Abrams, and he knows what it would have cost to have mentioned Bush and Barrick in the same sentence. And so a New York Times editor came up to me and said, that's the first time anyone has ever accused the New York Times of cowardice. Sorry. And Seymour Hersh leans over to me and says, that's the guy who had me fired from the Times. What, me lie? Yeah. By the way, I want to tell you about that. You know, the me lie massacre story, you know, that Hersh bylined in the Times, several other papers. get the idea that, you watch Murphy Brown, you're told that everyone's hunkering for that big story, right? Well, let me tell you, that story is actually first broken by a reporter, died young, one of the greatest reporters ever, Ron Ridenour. And he worked with Hirsch, brought Hirsch into the story, and they tried, well over a year, begging 50 different papers to attempt to run this story. They had to set their own news service. They begged they had the photographs, right? They had the witness statements. They had the My Lai Massacre story. They begged papers to run it and couldn't get it run. They had to threaten to put it out other ways. And finally, the Times relented and figured, okay. So it was giving into the story. It was not getting the story. The election theft story. Like I say, 7 months after I wrote it, the Washington Post said, well, we might as well mention it. History now. Iran-Contra story, broken by Bob Perry for the brilliant AP reporter, or I should say brilliant ex-AP reporter. He broke the story. He didn't get the Pulitzer Prize. He got fired. Investigative reporting is that investigative reporting is kind of an extinct species or, in exile. Unless we have, God bless you, indie media and real independent media. Let me tell you, kind of finish up on that story, Barrick Gold. What else did Bush do for this company? Turns out, according to their website, that he had helped them get a gold mine concession in Tanzania. And I hadn't read about this. I thought it might be interesting. Look it up. When Barrick Gold was trying to buy this gold mining concession in Tanzania that Bush helped them get, according to the company, the company that at that time owned the site was having trouble selling it to them because there were already miners, the prospectors, the gold miners, on just like in the U.S. gold rush. So in the middle of the night in August 96, and over a period of days, they swept across, in the middle of the night, they swept across the properties, the big gold mining area where these small prospectors were, with bulldozers, smashed down their houses, destroyed all their equipment, chased off all the workers, military police firing guns, sealed in their little pits, except that 50 miners were still in the pits when the pits were sealed up. I reported that. I hadn't read that anywhere. And I thought, maybe that's something that ought to be reported. I reported it, and my paper got sued by Bush's buddies. And they said, they wanted me, I said, look, give me your, I'll be happy, look. Tell me your side story. We'll print whatever you want on your side of the story. You tell us what your denials, whatever. No. We want you to sign the following statement that you can happily confirm that no one died in the peaceful clearance of the mines. I said, I'd be thrilled to say that if you give me any evidence. I said, what's your evidence? The evidence is that we've got $1 billion and you don't. That's the evidence. So I thought that wasn't enough. So I thought we encouraged one of the top human rights lawyers, investigators, and environmental lawyers in the world, Tundu Lisu, who was in Washington, to go to the mine site. He's Tanzanian, so he speaks Swahili, a perfect person to go to the site and say if people died or not. I could have it wrong. And he came back, sent back photocopies, sent back photos of crushed, mangled bodies, videotape of body parts being exhumed, eyewitness statements, sworn statements about the burials and killings. And I brought this to Barrick and said, well, so what do you want? They say, we want you to sign a statement that you can happily confirm that no one died. A peaceful clearance of the mine. I said, well, I can't do that. And that was not so easy because my paper was ready to shit bricks. And there was, and I have to say, Salon ran a story called Exporting Corporate Censorship, because they tried they tried to say that my paper would be liable for any, for my placing the story on an internet site in the United States, where we do have First Amendment, that because an internet site in the U.S. can be read in Britain, that we'd be liable under British law, which means that anything you write here makes you liable over there. Now, they can't get you, but let me tell you, the global corporations, networks, etc., NBC, etc., it doesn't matter if you have freedom of speech here. If it goes on the net and it goes there, you could be, they could be sued. You won't be sued. You're here. That's the end of that report, because they could be sued there. We just had a case in Australia, because someone read a U.S. internet site in Australia and the publisher got sued in Australia. So anyway, but the important thing is, so Tundu Lisu, he leaves the mine site with the evidence, and as he leaves, he and his law partners hold a press conference and say, and this is almost the exact words, he's speaking Swahili, so I have to get it translated, but he said simply, the evidence we have found at Bulyanhulu, which is the mine site, suggests that there ought to be an investigation of the events surrounding the clearance of the mine site. That was his statement, for which he was charged with sedition. That's why I'm telling you this. He left the country, though, before the charge came down. So then he calls. I speak to him about what the evidence is. He's in Washington. His wife stayed there. His wife just gave birth to twins. Congratulate him, and he said, I'm going back to Tanzania. I said, if you go back, you'll be arrested. I said, if I'm lucky. After his twins were born, he did go back. He was arrested, in and out of jails. His business partners were beaten up. His law offices have been burnt down. Opposition party member who brought it up on the floor of parliament was beaten and hospitalized. You read about that. That's one of the problems. And oh, did I tell you something else? There was a congressional investigation started of Barrick gold mining, because they were also, another great reporter, Wayne Madsen, had discovered that his information was that Barrick gold mining was supporting both sides of the civil war in the Congo, and supporting, and they had obtained a mining concession from the dictator Mobutu, who is a golfing buddy of George Bush, by the way. Kind of interesting. Can you imagine that golfing duo in a little... If you were a caddy and you gave him the wrong, you know, club, you know... back from Bush's CIA days. So they're golfing. They were golfing friends. Now Mobutu's dead. So there was an investigation opened of Barrick gold mining in Congress by one congressperson who was seeing whether this was the relations with Mobutu were fueling the civil war, undercutting U.S. policy, opening up an investigation of the Tanzanian mine, etc. That was Congresswoman Cynthia McKinney. And when the Tanzanian allegations came about, and before then, as you know, and then, because I was wondering why this attack on McKinney. And of course, as I mentioned, the Times was accurate in that two major leaders in Atlanta no longer supported McKinney. That's Vernon Jordan and Andy Young. They left out of the mention that on the board of Barrick Gold Mining is Vernon Jordan and Andy Young. No connections. Not in the world of the New York Times. Well, they don't give you the dots, so you can't draw the lines. But one final thing, I'll let you go or answer questions informally. I do want you to buy the book so you can. I really would, because it's you got to get the full stories. and sign up at my website. But I'll tell you this. CBS News, Dan Rather's operation, called me and asked me, can you give us a piece of this Florida story? I said, well, you're a competitor, but, you know, I want the story to get out in the U.S. media. They said, it's a great story, black people being thrown off the voter rolls. I said, yeah, you're going to run it, sure. Oh, by the way, the mining story, 60 Minutes called me about that, and I said, you're not going to run it. They said, oh, no, we can't decide. Ed Bradley can't decide whether it should be a segment on 60 Minutes or one of his hour-long specials. I said, you're not going to run it. 3 days later, they called up and said they weren't going to run it, and I think they had a profile of Tom Cruise at the very important. Something like that. Actually, that's very funny. We talk about British libel law, which I had to face down. We got notes from our lawyers going around the paper that said, do not disparage the marriage of Tom Cruise and Nicole Kidman. This was 2 days after they announced that they're getting divorced, because they'd sued a paper for saying that their marriage was in trouble. It's not in trouble. They don't have it anymore. CBS News says, give us something new and hot on this story. And I said, well, yeah, Jeb Bush's office, not just Catherine Harris, Jeb Bush's office got involved. And someone from inside his office told me that there was a letter dated September 18th, 2000, 6 weeks before the election, with Jeb Bush's office, through his Office of Executive Clemency within his department, ordered the removal of black voters, who would be mostly black, almost all Democrats, who came from other states with felony records, which you can't do in the United States. Okay, two courts have told Bush he can't do this. 50,000 people were barred from registering in Florida. 50,000. Almost everyone Democratic. Almost everyone. Okay, 50,000 voters. This is Jeb Bush's action, September 18th, 2000. But I didn't have the letter. The inside source said they read it, but they were scared to send it to me. I got two sources giving me the exact wording of the letter and the date, September 18th, 2000. CBS News doesn't run the story, so I called them up and I said, what happened? They said, it didn't stand up. This is a great line that you'll get if you work in I can hear that. That sound record. Didn't stand up, yeah. I said, what do you mean it didn't stand up? And they said, well, we called Jeb Bush's office, and they said, it wasn't true. Misunderstand. So I thought maybe I'd check into it myself, but I was having a tough time getting the actual letter. And then, Catherine Harris wrote this letter to Harper's Magazine, which ran part of the story, the blackout in Florida. And Catherine Harris wrote in this long screed, Greg Palast, twisted and maniacal, but he didn't say I was wrong. And she's going on, but don't blame, it was this whole thing, then don't blame me. Sorry about the black voters, but in this terrible system, I admit it, and blah, 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 but it's not my fault. Everyone else told me to do it, including, I got this letter from the governor. And I'm thinking, that rang a bell with me. CBS had moved on. But I hadn't, and I called up Harris's office. I called the Secretary of State's office. I said, I got this letter from the Secretary of State. I didn't say it was Mr. Twist and Maniacal. She mentions a letter that she got from the governor, and I wonder if you could fax that to me. I'd appreciate it because she's referencing it in her letter, and I'd just like to see it. And I suspect, I'm not quite sure, but I believe that the letter is dated September 18th, 2000. And that's all the news that's fit to get you exiled. So catch the book. Go to my website, www.gregpalast.com. See these evil reports I do on BBC that you're not supposed to see. Read some of the evil dispatches from The Guardian that you're not supposed to see. And sign up to get more reports. And sign up, I really need some, like today, I'm supposed to have copies of Counting on Democracy here. Just this is very typical. This, like Michael Moore complains about us on the, he says, you know, the Republicans have it all together. You know, they figured out in the right wing, they figure out, you know, they get up early in the morning, they figure out how to screw you. Like, they have a program, right? And, you know, like, I'm having the master redubbed here, you know, and now we've gotten two masters with bad audio. You know, it's like, so I just need someone, like, who will volunteer to, like, listen to the tape so that, you know, you can actually hear what's going on as Clayton runs away. But, so I do need your help. We can only do this with volunteer help or some paid helpers working as an organization. So sign on. Anyway, thank you very much. And thank you for being independent. That's even more important than being media. You know, because they can shut down the media, but they can't shut down your independence if you decide to be that way. Thank you. Thank you very much.